Now for a little conversation with Miss Ella Fitzgerald.
Gene Rayburn here. I'd like you to meet a friend of mine. Here come the George. Here come the George. Here come the George. Here come the George. No, I'm not saying here come the judge. Here come the George. George Carlin, your monitor host this evening, will open up a whole new hippy-dippy world to you. Welcome to Monitor, George.
You're sounding less like Ella every day. Thank you, Gene. George Carlin here, and we will talk with Ella Fitzgerald. There aren't many singers around these days whose first name only means instant identification. But our monitor guest right now is one of those rare ones. She's also known as the First Lady of Song, a nickname given to her by other singers. And it's indeed a pleasure to extend a most cordial monitor welcome to you, Miss Ella Fitzgerald.
It's a pleasure to be on your program. May I call you George?
Please.
I feel like we know each other now.
Right. You're appearing at the Rainbow Grill.
Yes, and I'm having a ball.
I was going to ask you, how was opening?
Oh, it was beautiful, and the room is such a... Such an intimate room, you know, that I think most singers would just love this type of room to sing. And here you're up on the 65th floor and you're looking all over. It's just like singing in heaven.
Yeah, gotta make you feel good.
Yeah.
You know, I must say that I haven't been up there ever, and I don't know how large it is. And I wondered if you carry a normal complement of musicians up there. Do you work with a smaller group?
I work with the trio up there.
Oh, that's nice, yeah. I like trio.
Yes, it makes it very intimate.
It seems to me that jazz has stopped changing somehow. In the last 10 years, I don't notice a new trend in jazz. A few things are being done, but in the 40s we had bebop, and in the 50s we had the West Coast sound, cooler jazz. They were always changing a bit. Why has that stopped?
I'd say the trend maybe in the States has changed a little. We don't emphasize jazz as much in the States, but on our travels in the other countries, jazz is almost like a classical topic or something. When we play the concerts, that's what the audience come for. They believe in it. It's part of music. And I believe that's why there's so many musicians have gone overseas to work, because there aren't too many places.
That's right.
In the States that...
Jazz is an American art form, and it's not appreciated here.
It's not really appreciated. There are girls like Carmen McRae and Sarah Vaughan that I feel are so underrated, and I should say Miss Peggy Lee, because I my greatest education came from Dizzy Gillespie. That's the first time I ever learned how to, what you say, do bebop, actually, when I traveled with Dizzy Gillespie's orchestra, and my first big hit was Lady Be Good, and then from that we made a record of it, and it was a big hit for me.
I like that thing that you do, and Mac the Knife is one of my favorite performances of yours. That was done in Germany, wasn't it?
Yeah, I never knew what I was doing then.
Wow. I must say that one of the things you do that I like is in the middle of a song like that, when you're doing a bunch of choruses on your own, you throw in little things like... It's a groove. I love it.
We didn't know what we were doing, and it was funny because the added choruses are things that everybody was looking at each other as if to say, well, do we go out here? But that's how the extra choruses came, because we just didn't know where to go out.
I played it plenty of times. I was a disc jockey at that time. Your nomination for an Emmy Award for the work with Frank Sinatra and Jobim on the TV special is the first time a guest performer has ever been nominated. I'm sure you're pleased and proud about that. Is there anything you can tell us? Do you help each other sing?
Who could help this man sing? Let's face it. He has so much feeling and experience, what he puts into a song, it's like someone telling you a story. He just puts you at ease, and he just said what you want to sing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I just had a ball, and I just felt so relaxed, and it was just like somebody say to you, well, go ahead, baby. You're on your own.
Do your thing, yeah.
Yeah.
I know that you still have some goals set for yourself. Would you care to tell us which ones and why?
Well, I think my goal has always been something associated with children. I feel if I had the time, I would just love to give more time, because like the song says, what the world needs now is love. And if I think they need so much love to give them that strength that they need.
On the subject of love, I guess it would be a good place for me to say our monitor guest these past few moments, one of the all-time greats of popular music, Miss Ella Fitzgerald. And thank you, Ella, for coming by.
Thank you, George. It's been a pleasure.
Saving the best for last, here's a song from Ella.
I taught him everything.
Campbell, a guy who knows his way around a song and a guitar, is my guest in a couple of minutes, so stay on the monitor beacon. Among the younger musicians who have helped to shape the new sound of American popular music is a versatile fellow named Glenn Campbell. Glenn does everything, it seems, and does it well. He sings, plays guitar, composes, and arranges, among other things. And Wednesday night on NBC television, Glenn receives 4 Grammy Awards from the recording industry for some of his work this year. Now, the Campbell music career is no overnight success story, however, as you'll discover in the following chat between Glenn and Monitor reporter Dave Niles in San Francisco.
Glenn Campbell, what is your background? Are you from the West, Southwest, or?
Arkansas. Delight, Arkansas.
Hot dog, hot dog. Did you start singing as a strictly Western entertainer or Western instrumentalist, per se?
No, I started really singing when I was just a kid in Prescott, Arkansas. We had a radio show down there when I was like 7 or 8 years old, and started playing and singing gospel songs, hymns, Western, all kinds of music. I got involved in studio work in Los Angeles doing... I worked on movies like Hood and just doing music, playing guitar, you know. Mm-hmm. And In the Heat of the Night, I think, was the last picture I worked on with Quincy Jones. Got to work with the people that I admired very much, like Frank Sinatra or Dean Martin. He's my favorite person, I guess. And you get to work with the musicians you admire, too, like Shelly Manne or Barney Kessel or Buddy Collette. Roland Kirk did the electric flute stuff on Heat of the Night. Just fantastic.
Well, obviously you have to be a pretty good guitarist, not just one of these fellows that plunks along behind his good singing. Well, how did you get started in this? I mean,
I did a couple of sessions with Jimmy Haskell, the arranger, and Jimmy started using me on a couple of dates, and I don't read.
I play by ear,
right. And it's hard on your ear sometimes.
Yeah.
But, I read chord sheets, and enough to get by. It just kind of busted open from there, and I do like 500 recording sessions a year.
Wow. Now, there's good money in that, right?
Yes, there is.
You did commercials, too, huh?
Right. The commercials, there's good money in commercials. But my New Year's resolution in 67 was just to work on Glenn Campbell, and it's working out great so far.
I would say so. Now, Glenn, you also write songs, huh?
Write some, yes.
Did, how about the, let's see, Gentle on My Mind was one that maybe everybody will remember, and then the next one, I guess, was By the Time I Get to Phoenix. Did you write either one of those?
No, I didn't. I just happened to find the songs.
You wrote Turn Around, Look at Me, though.
Right.
Right.
I wrote John Davidson's new single called Visions of Sugar Plums with Jerry Fuller.
Uh-huh.
And I'm batting like 98% in writing. I record some of my stuff that I write. Other people's recorded. Bobby Darin's recorded one. Keely Smith's recorded a couple of them.
How do you dream these things up? I guess everybody has a different method, huh?
Right. You write according to situations or personal things that happen to you. And I wrote a song called Less of Me when I was on the road with the Beach Boys. I toured with the Beach Boys for about 6 months, playing bass and singing the high parts, you know. And I saw a little sign that says, think more of others and a little less of yourself.
So you got an idea, huh?
Right. Yeah. I wrote a song called Less of Me. I wrote Less of Me in 20 minutes.
Wow.
It's a good song. It's been like 20 albums by different artists.
I see you on television. I think, gee, here's a young, good-looking guy, full of talent. How does this happen? People, I guess most of us don't realize that you have been working at this for a long, long time.
Yes, I have. All my life.
It's really broken for you now, though, huh?
Yes, I guess it's paying off, and knock on wood.
Glenn Campbell, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Dave Niles for Monitor in San Francisco.
A brief portrait of Glenn Campbell. And here's the award-winning song you'll see him do Wednesday night on the Best on Record, the Grammy show on NBC TV.
By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising. The note I left hanging on her door. She'll laugh when she reads the part that says I'm leaving. 'Cause I've left that girl so many times before. By the time I make Albuquerque, she'll be working. She'll probably stop. stop at lunch and give me a call.
Mother's Day reservations?
Call your FDD florist. Make Mother's Day flower reservations now.
The month of May is National Radio Month, and talking about radio for me is like talking about my hometown and my alma mater. I began in radio. I began in one of those top 40 stations with the good guys, the big side, the big tunes, right now the bad, the big side, the big chat, the big tunes, you know what's getting to me. And I slowed down as the years went by. I began in Shreveport, thanks to Joe Monroe at KJOE. I went to Boston, didn't stay there very long, and I went to Fort Worth, thanks to George Falder. I was down at KXOL. And would you believe it, across the nation, 3 million people are listening to Saturday Night Monitor, just like they do every weekend. And, Joe, I guess it worked. By the way, you folks out there, I do want to say hi to you in those towns. You remember me. I was there not long ago. I sincerely hope your children turned out okay in spite of hearing my show. Of course, it's no surprise that radio reaches so many people. It reaches more in the United States than any other medium. This is National Radio Month. It's Tijuana Brass, and the song is called Slick. Another pretty slick item, Monitor, available on NBC across the nation. In Green Bay, Wisconsin, we're heard on WNFL. What else? All stations will identify themselves, then Monitor returns. Me too, your hippy-dippy host, George Carlin.
Al Capp visits the University of Indiana, next on the NBC Radio Network.
There's nothing quite like a brief pause for Monitor music. Here's a good example, Al Caiola's orchestra and the Scalp Hunters theme. Frankie and our gang come to monitor right now with Like to Get to Know You.
But I'd like to get to know you.
Yes, I would.
But I'd like to get to know you.
If I could.
But I'd like to get to know you.
Finally, I found, searching all around, just was not the answer. What I thought was true looked a bit like you. I figured I might chance her.
But I'd like to get to know you.
Yes, I would.
Monitor half hour, the accent is on youth. You'll hear excerpts from a campus debate between Al Capp, our talking cartoonist, and members of a student panel at Indiana State University in Terre Haute. As we join the group, Mr. Capp has the floor.
Now, I'm one of the very few out-of-towners who have come to Indiana this week to speak to students. I'm one of the very few who will speak to students who isn't running for president. And so I don't have to lie to you. Now, there are a couple of other fellas who are going to hit town. As a matter of fact, talk to you right from this podium, who may tell you in the course of the evening that you're just as smart as they are. Now, they may really think you are, but I assure you that any man over 40 that tells a bunch of students under 20 that they are just as smart as they are probably right. You won't hear anything like that from me. Actually, I've come here largely to hear from all of you. And what my generation's been hearing from you mainly have been complaints. And I've come here to hear your complaints, and we've selected some of the most brilliant complainers at this university to represent you on stage with some of the definitive and nagging complaints. But there is one catch to it, every time any of you up on stage or down below in the pit complain about the mess we've made of the world you're about to inherit, after you whine about it, you then must tell me how you propose to do it better. How about Pete Burgers?
Well, it seems that many spokesmen of your generation, such as Mayor Daley of Chicago, advocate shooting of rioters. My generation...
No, he advocated the shoot. Let's get it correct. Shooting of arsonists.
Okay.
Yes.
My generation, hopefully, will not advocate the killing of arsonists.
What will you do to a man who sets fire to a building in which there are people who may be burned to death? How will you discourage this sport?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's a sport. You were the one who called it a sport. I'm not calling it
a sport. Well, Mayor Daley doesn't think it's a sport either. He wants them killed.
I know that, and hopefully our generation won't. Let me give me a chance to answer.
Right, yeah.
Hopefully, if a policeman is within range to shoot, to kill, he's also in range to make the arrest. And we have in the United States a court system to try the lawbreakers. And I hopefully that if they can shoot them, they can also make the arrest and take them to court.
Then you want policemen to not try to apprehend arsonists, not try to stop them with bullets. By the way, before any policeman shoots, he must, by law, ask several times for the suspect to stop.
Well,
you know
do
that,
they?
Don't you?
Do they?
If they don't, they're criminals. I would imagine the police, by and large, does.
You think they're criminals?
I don't think they're criminals. I think the police obey the law, by and large. There are just as many corrupt policemen as there are depraved college students, I'll admit. But by and large, I do believe the police obey the law, so that a policeman doesn't instantly take his gun out and shoot an arsonist. He tries to stop him.
This is what Mayor Daley wanted, though. This is what he called for on TV.
This is not what Mayor Daley called for on TV.
Well, what did he call for?
He called for the killing of any man who sets fire to a building in which people may be baked alive if the man, and it's understood in what he said, if the man doesn't give himself up.
He has an opportunity to make the arrest. If he has the opportunity to make the arrest, why should he kill the man?
Let's say the man doesn't want to be arrested.
Well, we answer the question. If he has the opportunity to make the arrest before shooting, why would he not make it?
Then let's say...
Would you want him to make the arrest?
Certainly.
Okay.
Then if the man who has just set fire to that building in which there are many families will not submit to arrest, then what does the policeman do?
Well, he would take action. He would have to...
What do you mean by taking action?
Well, whatever the situation
is. Well, now say it. What is it? He's got a gun.
It may be a billy club. It may be...
A billy club is awful hard to throw 20 yards.
The point was, if the policeman had the arsonist there and he couldn't handle the situation, then what would he do? I would say the situation would have to dictate to the policeman his own discretion.
That's right, including shooting to kill, right? Now say it instead of those weasel words, taking action. Why don't you say it?
Because I don't think he has to shoot to kill.
All right, let's use taking action.
There's a man in the audience. Why don't we see what he has to say?
Yes.
I'd like to say two things. First of all, last summer during the riots in the cities, many firemen were shot by people who tried to stop them from putting out fires.
Exactly.
Secondly, when a policeman is involved in a situation of mob rule, there are very few people who will stop doing something after a policeman says stop. Ordinarily, violence must be controlled with a certain amount of violence. If people that set fires are stopped immediately, if they are shot, then many of these things would probably not happen as often.
Yes. Now, Pete, do you... do you agree with that, or do you feel that still the punishment for arson should be a dirty look?
Well, you said that. I didn't say that at all.
Well, you said take action, and this is what I said in the beginning. Oh, this is what Mayor Daley said, except that he translated that into honest words.
Well,
when you translate it into honest words, we'll have a meeting of the mind.
If he's close enough range to see an arson, then he's close enough to make the arrest.
I see. And then let's say the distance widens. Here goes the record again. And then what does he do? He has a gun. The man has set fire to a building. If he escapes, he'll set fire to another one. What does the policeman do?
Who says he's going to set fire to another one?
You say he won't.
I'm not saying he won't. You're the one that's saying he will.
I say that you have a childlike faith in the integrity of arsonists that I don't share.
The only thing that frightens me about shooting arsonists is, are they going to wear a sign that says, I am an arsonist? If your building's on fire and you run from it and you're thinking about other people in the building or your possessions or things like that, what if you don't hear and you're just running to, so you won't be burned up? The policeman might shoot you thinking you're an arsonist and think himself perfectly justified when you're just an occupant.
It's quite true. It's quite true. And can you name those people who have been shot as arsonists, how many of them have been shot when really they were just fleeing the building as compared to arsonists who have set fire to buildings, burnt people alive, and gotten away with it because the police were handcuffed?
But still, when you put the judge, jury, and executioner in the hands of one man, he's fallible.
Do you want to put the lives of everyone in that tenement house in the hands of the arsonist instead?
They've both broken the law, but they're both entitled to justice.
They have not both broken the law. The policeman on duty with a gun drawn is defending the law and you. And be grateful to him that he's willing to do it.
More give and take between Al Capp and the students at Indiana State University in Terre Haute in just 1 minute, so stay on the Monitor Beacon. More of Monitor now. George Carlin, your host, and it's 14 and a half minutes before the hour. Now let's rejoin that campus debate between a panel of students at Indiana State University in Terre Haute and our traveling and talking cartoonist, Al Capp.
Right now, I want to make a plea against discrimination. You know, there is one group of in this country, one minority group who is loathed, despised, hated, and reviled because they're of a different color than the rest of us. They're blue. They're police. This tiny policeman didn't ask to be blue. That's the color they are. Don't let's hate them and beat them because they're blue. Let's treat them as equals.
Are you going to give the policeman a course in recognizing arsonists?
I think policemen are human beings, if you will accept that.
Well, that's my very point.
I think that policemen have no wish to murder. They have no wish to risk being slaughtered by angry mobs for having shot too fast. This has never been the case in any of the riots.
Oh, in Detroit, there were three Negro boys shot.
Have either not shot at all until the city was half in flames, or they have used their guns much too slowly. We don't provide policemen with guns simply as part of their ornate dress. We provide them with guns because they need guns to protect us.
Why don't they need guns in Britain?
I beg your pardon?
The Bobby in Britain doesn't carry a gun.
Well, this is another society. You're now talking about a society so different from ours that there is no comparison at all. And the evening is too short to even describe the differences. There's a civilization that goes back centuries that has produced the unarmed London Bobby and the citizen in London who doesn't riot. I want to hear one word of criticism against the riot. I've heard the policeman dance. I want to hear the man who sets fire to a building. I want to hear him denounced by this audience.
I agree with you, but do we have to kill him?
I want to hear some words of criticism from your generation of the man who has set fire to the building across the way who shoots the fireman. who has been summoned to save that building shoots him in the back.
I can't criticize that man.
I want to hear some word of criticism of him from you.
I agree with you, but there's a system in the United States that we have to uphold, right?
The judicial system. Yes.
It seems like you're trying to cut down the police and the people who try to keep things down.
No, I'm not trying to cut down the police. I'm trying to keep the
law. You're trying to put handcuffs on the policemen.
Pardon?
If the policemen have handcuffs and have their arms tied behind their back, how do you expect them to protect you?
Have you ever seen a policeman with handcuffs, his hands tied behind his back?
I have seen
Well, I'm asking you a question.
Let him give us a chance. Yeah, I'm sorry to have interrupted.
That's okay.
Anytime at all. You must come to one of my meetings.
When you say the phrase Mr. and Mrs. Ward Donovan,
Mr. and Mrs. Ward Donovan,
it sounds like the couple next door, right?
Wrong.
The Donovans happen to be actor-singer Ward Donovan and his wife, one of the funniest ladies of all time, Phyllis Diller. Phyllis and Ward are currently touring the nightclub circuit, appearing together. Next fall on NBC TV, the beautiful Phyllis Diller Show debuts. About that title, Phyllis says, right away you know it's not a documentary. Miss Diller has a serious as well as kooky side, and you'll see some of both as she talks with Monitor reporter Jack Eigen in Chicago.
I want to talk about the romantic Phyllis Diller night, if you don't mind. You know, up until now, everything is funny, funny, funny. And people don't know the other side of Phyllis Diller, the romance of Phyllis Diller, the sentimental Phyllis Diller, the Phyllis Diller who spurts poetry if you wake her up all of a sudden, and things of that type. But, I mean, did you find that this was an immediate romance, or didn't you dig him, as it usually goes, when you first met him?
No, when I met him, they brought him down the aisle, and there's a certain protocol of the theater, and I had never been in theater before. This was my first book show, what they call it, a musical, and they introduce the lady to the cast. You know, it's very formal. Well, as formal as you can be in blue jeans and sneakers. And then they bring the leading man to the leading lady, and they say, and this is your leading man. And I said one word. Wow.
And that's how it happened. What was your word? What, did you have a word?
He said, ugh.
Do you get the same kick out of her that the audience gets? Or, I mean, you know us so well now, but you watch it, do you break up the way an audience breaks up, or do you feel, well, that's...
Oh, absolutely. And the thing is that every time she says something funny, I get a pencil and write it down when she's not on. And of course, it's fascinating to think that all these lines of hers and her ideas are going to be out next season on NBC TV when she does the beautiful Phyllis Diller Show.
Nothing bothers Phyllis. She lives from the time she gets up until she goes to bed. There's not a negative bone in her body. With you, life is beautiful, right, Phyllis?
True, absolutely.
Have you always been that way? Or?
No, I'm corrected.
Corrected?
Corrected. I think everyone should correct. You know, a lot of people go through life blaming an uncle, an aunt, an old maid school teacher, a friend with a wart on her nose with a hair growing out of it. I love your mother, Greg. She's a beautiful woman. She reminds me of my mother-in-law, Moby Dick. But you know, and I say that when you get to a certain age, you must take over yourself. And there are books around to read about self-help, which is what I did, because at the time I didn't have time to lie down with a psychiatrist, for heaven's sakes, and I couldn't have afforded it when I was so mentally sick and negative and frightened. And then I read a couple of books, or lots of books, or lots of things, and I did controlled reading. I read only things that would make you become positive.
You were a housewife, lots of children in St. Louis.
I was a failure.
Phyllis was here in Chicago for 3 years, and she went to Northwestern, and she was also going to Sherwood Music School to learn to be a concert pianist and an opera singer.
No, I didn't know. I don't think too many people are aware of that.
I try to cover it.
She was also a waitress at the Lawson Street YMCA. Are you ready for that?
No, it's the YM. I didn't mess around at the YW, I'll tell you that.
You were a waitress?
Well, I was working my way through music school, and I did have great ambitions to be a musician. And I never made it up, but I one day, I was such a failure. For instance, if anyone gave me a dirty look, it would just absolutely shrivel me to a fetal position. I'd pull the covers over my head and stop breathing.
Now, how can...
Well, that's insecurity.
Of course it is.
But the
I couldn't afford a blanket.
Well, what got you on a... What got you on a road to security? I mean, was it yourself? Would someone say, come on now, Phyllis, stop
being... No. It wasn't that. It was things I read. As I say, I started... somebody must have put in my hands positive sort of reading. One, I read those little Unity things that come out every day. And then I read one book that made the most difference in my life, and that was The Magic of Believing. And it's not about religion. It's simply about believing in yourself. And then that led me to a sort of a personal philosophy that God is in you and in other people when they're alive. Therefore, when you speak to anyone, you're speaking to God. And when you believe in yourself, you're believing in God in you. And I got a kind of a wonderful working-type religion for our modern day because the nomenclature of old religions is so out of date. It's come through so many translations, you know.
You know, I was just thinking, you are starring, you star in nightclubs, in motion pictures, television. You've even got a comic strip out now that I read occasionally. And what else do you want to do yet that you haven't done? There's nothing else for you to do, actually.
Oh, my dear boy.
A concert pianist and an opera singer.
No. I've got
Phyllis Diller at Carnegie Hall.
I've already done that.
No, but I tell you.
I'm just saying, just playing it like with the Jack Benny on the violin.
That's exactly what she should do. Exactly. We're going to do the Taboo ad.
Right.
You know, the old broad with the, and he's playing the violin and he grabs my body.
The incredible Phyllis Diller, a great combination of comedy and common sense.
Made Mother's Day reservations?
Mother's Day reservations?
Call your FTD florist. Make Mother's Day flower reservations now.
I'm a sucker for a soft, lovely voice, and so we'll hear from the new Miss Monitor in just 1 minute. So stay with the hippy-dippy happy people here on the Monitor Beacon.
Here comes more of the Monitor.
Thank you, gang. And the old clock in the cow's stomach tells me it's exactly 19 minutes past the hour. Your host, George Carlin, we have a wonderful surprise for you. We've discovered a charming young lady who's ready, willing, and able to make weather reports sound like something out of Arabian Nights. Here comes the new hippy-dippy Miss Monitor.
Sault Ste. Marie?
That's Sue.
Sault Ste. Sue?
Never mind.
Secaucus, 68 and clear. Vladivostok, 14 below and freezing. Philadelphia, no weather today. Sydney, 41 and clear. Ralph, 45 and very unclear. Dayton, 45 and cloudy. Berkeley, 83 and tense.
The new Miss Monitor, a lovely girl, really, and a hard worker. Thank you, dear. Don't call us. We'll call you, maybe. Heard the latest from Jerry Vale? We'll listen.
My love for... fall in love with me. My love, please kiss me. Arrivederci. just a slight flirtation. That was all it was to be. How could I know this fascination? How to tell you of my heartache? How to tell you I'm not free? How can I bear to see your heart break? To see your heart break over me? Che lasciando te io soffrirò. Amore, baciami, arrivederci, amore, baciami, e se mi penserai ricordati.
Exciting voice of Jerry Vail, and I'm happy to say I'll be joining Jerry Vail this Tuesday at the Frontier Hotel in Las Vegas for a three-week engagement. I'll be there with all of my friends, the Hippy Dippy Weatherman in Kangalia, and our good friend
Biff Barf here with the Sportlight Spotlight, spotlighting sports in the Sportlight Spotlight. In the Sportlight Spotlight tonight, we spotlight a sportlighted sport, no sports.
Mel, but let me get an expert, please. At the Monitor Sports Desk now, Mel Allen.
Thank you very much, George. Hello there, everybody. A horse who supposedly had bad ankles, whose owner tried to sell him a year ago, won the 94th Kentucky Derby today after running dead last for the first half of the race. Dancer's Image came on strong in the stretch, took the lead with a 16th of a mile to go, then scored a length and a half victory over favored Forward Pass. Francis Hatt was third by a neck in the field of 14 three-year-olds. Time for the mile and a quarter, a slow 2:02 and a fifth. The winning jockey was Bobby Ussery, who was aboard last year's winner, Proud Clarion. He became the first man in 66 years to ride consecutive Derby champions, and only the third in history to do it. And he turned the trick the hard way along the rail in the stretch after he lost his whip during the race. Dancer's Image thus won the only race that eluded his more famous daddy, the great native dancer. Dancer's Image paid $9.20 to win. Ironically, his owner, breeder, Peter Fuller of Boston, tried to sell him in February 1967, put Dancer's Image up for auction, hoping to get $35,000 for him. But when the price hung at $25,000, Fuller's wife insisted that he keep the colt. So Fuller bid him in with a $1,000 raise. Of such stuff is the history of the Kentucky Derby and its champions written. Elsewhere in racing, Dr. Fager made his first appearance of the 1968 season today, and came within a fifth of a second of the Aqueduct track record for 7 furlongs in winning the $54,000 Rose Bend handicap by 3 lengths from Tumiga. Diplomat Wave was third, the time 1:21 2/5. After the third round of Houston Champions Golf Tournament, the leader is Dan Sykes. Shot a 69 today for a 54-hole score of 203 and a 1-stroke lead over Miller Barber and Lee Trevino. Tied for fourth at 2:06, Jack Nicklaus and Robert DiVincenzo. Now on the Monitor baseball scoreboard in the American League, Cleveland shut out Minnesota 2-0 as Steve Hargan beat Dave Boswell. A pregame accident sent Minnesota pitcher Dean Chance to the hospital with an injury to the left side of his jaw. He was standing on the sidelines watching batting practice when a ball thrown by Twins infielder Richie Rhee struck him. Chicago beat the New York Yankees 4-1. As rookie Cisco Carlos pitched hitless ball for 6 2/3 innings. Pete Ward hit a home run for the White Sox. Fred Talbot was the losing pitcher. By the way, a single by Mickey Mantle and a pinch double by Steve Whitaker were the only hits off Carlos. California beat Detroit 7-2. Jim McLaughlin, the winning pitcher. Earl Wilson, the loser. Roger Repos hit a pair of homers for California. He now has 8 tops in the majors. For Detroit, Willie Horton and Bill Freehan homered. Oakland 4, Boston 2. Lou Krause beat Dick Ellsworth. Rick Mundy and Danny Kaner homered for Oakland. And Baltimore took Washington 5-3 as Jim Harden beat Phil Ortega. Frank Howard homering for the Senators. In the National League, the New York Mets beat the Chicago Cubs 7-3 as Dick Selma was the winning pitcher, Jack LeMabe the loser. Ed Charles homered for the Mets and Randy Hundley for the Cubs. St. Louis 11, San Francisco 6. Mike Torres the winning pitcher, Ray Sadecki the loser. Tim McCarver homered for the Cards and for the Giants. Willie Mays got the 569th of his career. Willie McCovey hit a grand slammer. Tonight, Pittsburgh's at Philadelphia, Atlanta at Houston, Cincinnati at Los Angeles. In tennis, the United States clinched its first-round Davis Cup American Zone Series with the British West Indies. Stan Smith and Bob Lutz won the doubles from Richard Russell and Lance Lumsden 6-2, 6-3, 6-3 to give the United States an unbeatable 3-love lead in the best-of-5 match series. In the North American Soccer League, it was Cleveland 2, Baltimore 1. Sid Salomon, president of the St. Louis Blues of the National Hockey League, said today he'll do everything in his power to bring the National Basketball Association back to St. Louis. Mayor Victor Shiro of New Orleans said he's very optimistic that his city will be awarded the 1969 Super Bowl game. Southwest Conference football champion Texas A&M reprimanded by the conference for 4 recruiting violations. And that's the latest sports news, George.
Thank you, Mel. Mel Allen with our sports roundup. And for more features and news from the world of sports, stay tuned to Monitor. Great number, Take the A-Train, done there by Trombones Unlimited. You're with Monitor, enjoyable weekend listening all across the nation. Folks in the Youngstown, Ohio area hear us on WFMJ, the Good Neighbor Station. Time for all stations to say hello, then Monitor continues. This is George Carlin.
Don't go away, there's more to come, more to interest everyone. Just stay tuned, we'll be back soon with all.